If any of you have over the years been any place on the New Jersey shore, you'll know that in the last, the last decade, the last 15 years or so, it became obvious that over many years, if not many decades, the very long beach area on the New Jersey shore had been very, very gradually eroded. And what's interesting is that even though that erosion was going on literally right before people's eyes, it didn't really dawn on people until about 10 or 15 years ago when you realize there wasn't much beach left at all. And so the state of New Jersey had to spend a phenomenal amount of money, a lot of equipment, I mean, fascinating work to see how these beaches are rebuilt up. But over many, many years, the Jersey shore had to literally be rebuilt. It still is not the same as what it was, but it's certainly somewhat better than it had been before. And that is something of a metaphor for what has happened in our own land, in particular in not just the last 20 years, but I think really pretty much in the last century. It becomes a metaphor for the erosion of the beach line of what I'm simply going to call historic Christian standards in so many areas. There was a certain agreed upon historic Christian understanding of marriage, that when you're married, there is not to be divorce, even if there's divorce for adultery or desertion. That was a permission and not a command. When you married, it was literally for life, until death do you part, for better or for worse, and so on. And that was a pretty much an historic, an agreed-upon standard, non-negotiable. Until about 40 years ago or so, there were agreed-upon standards of child-rearing for Christians in the churches regarding discipline, regarding instruction. There were variations on the theme, but there were certain things that were agreed upon and understood regarding what was accepted of children and what was accepted, what was to be done in child-rearing. Up till about 100 years ago or less, there were certain agreed upon standards regarding the Sabbath and regarding the Lord's Day, agreed upon not just in Presbyterian and Reformed churches, but in Episcopal churches, in Lutheran churches, even to some extent in Roman Catholic churches. That beach has been very much eroded. There were certain standards regarding worship that were accepted, that were agreed upon. The fact that worship is to be a place of reverence. The fact that worship is to be God-centered. I must confess, frankly, if I had a choice between what passes as worship, even in some Presbyterian and Reformed churches, and being in a staid Anglican church, I'd take the Anglican church any day. The fact that worship has become man-centered in many churches is just something that is not acceptable by historic Christian standards, and yet that beachhead has been eroded. Finances and debt. Historic Christian standard is you avoid debt. Today, debt is seen as a way of life, even the way finances are managed. Material possessions. We're a very materialistic culture. Historic standards of material possessions, very different from what we have today. The concept of entertainment. The idea that entertainment meant that you could indulge the lust of the flesh was something that would have been abhorrent 50 years ago. Today, that's regarded as acceptable under the guise of Christian liberty. Pertinent for our topic is the matter of dress and modesty. Again, up until maybe 50 years ago, I think a watershed in many of these areas is the 1960s, there were certain accepted standards of dress by both men and women, and I would say even by Christians and non-Christians. There were certain accepted standards of what was regarded as modest by Christians and non-Christians. Over particularly the last 45 or 50 years or so, that area has been terribly, terribly eroded. The waves of the world in that area, as in others, have really eroded the beach line of historic Christian standards. And I think, if I'm reading things correctly, just kind of keep aware of what's going on in the evangelical and reformed world, the churches are a little bit like the state of New Jersey. The erosion was going on all around you, but you didn't realize it until the beach was almost gone. And now, in tapes and in certain publications, at least the issue of Christian modesty is beginning to be addressed, and that certainly is helpful. I'd like to think that since we're a Reformed congregation and an Orthodox Presbyterian church, that that hasn't affected us here. It certainly has not affected us here, as I know it's affected other areas, and for that we're thankful, but it has affected us here. The comments that have come to the session, to elders in the past month, the past few months, particularly since the summer, regarding what is being worn by some people. In one case, at least, a letter that I received from a very, very exercised single male in the congregation. And also our need to, at least in some cases anyway, speak personally to individuals about this has impressed upon the elders that we really need to deal with the issue of Christian modesty in a thoughtful, useful, and a public manner. Not spastic. We want to think about what we're doing. We want to be useful. One of the volumes I'm going to quote from today that has been recommended by a pastor that our elders know well and respect is very, very high on criticizing culture and what has happened, particularly because of the influence of swimwear. I've read the volume. I'm going to quote from part of it in this day. I can't honestly say I would recommend it because it's very strong on criticizing a culture, but it's pitifully weak on addressing issues positively. And brothers and sisters, I can be as critical of a culture as anybody can. But let's follow the principle that it is much better to light a candle than to curse the darkness. The world is going to do what the world does. How do we seek to be children of light in the world is what ought to possess us. And in a public manner. The very fact that we need to take times with this means that we are concerned publicly before you and before others that this matter be addressed in this congregation. And we will feel the liberty, having dealt with this publicly, to, as necessary, deal with matters privately. The original plan was to begin addressing this at a men's breakfast. We had to postpone that because that was the week in which Larry Stavish's funeral was held in North Carolina, and it wouldn't be good for me to try to get back and arrange to do that. In the Lord's providence, that's good. It's good, I think, that I deal with this systematically and give you some instruction from the Word of God. And then the plan for our men is on the first Saturday in October is what we hope will be the first of succession of Saturdays. We have men's breakfast dealing more informally with these topics. But for now, systematic instruction from the Word of God. And let me give you a note on the way I've prepared for this. I have benefited from listening to others on the subject of modesty. I have benefited from reading others, Christians and non-Christians, on the subject of modesty. But I've chosen not to follow the approach that these people have used in various ways. Not that I'm against it, but because I think this is going to come across better for you and it'll come across better for me if this is really just my own material to you. So having read material and continuing to read and listen, I'm just really reflecting on the subject myself, and I've spoken with my better half, Margaret, bouncing ideas off and so on. And so that's how I prepared for this material. I don't profess to have all of the answers on this area. We value your input. One of my notes to the elders when we meet before worship is to keep their ears open. We want your questions. We want your suggestions. If you disagree, please raise your disagreements. During question and answer time in the class, I do not appreciate arguments. Questions, issues you're struggling with are fine, but this is not really a place to argue these issues. I'm going to try to stay away from things that would be unnecessarily controversial, but I want this to be edifying. In fact, I would go so far as to say that I will try to guard this material and what I present, making it so in line with what the Scriptures say, that if you really sit and steam and have a problem with it, you probably have a problem with your own heart. And so that's how I'm trying to gauge this material. I wish that other material dealing with the subject were like that, but not all of it is. Now here's my format. This morning I want to give you, in the time that now I think I know I have, simply a framework of the meaning of biblical terms. And I'm going to do a lot of reading today with hopefully a lot of comments in the middle. I just want you to hear what the biblical terms are and let that work on you. And I would suggest if you have some way to take notes, do it. Next week, God willing, I want to give you a number of correlative issues they are not actually parallel issues. They are related to the issue of modesty directly, but they're not exactly modesty issues. But they're connected with it, correlative issues. Number three, in the third week, I want to give you some basic practical directives. And then there will be time for questions and answers. I would assume that basic practical directives will be rather brief and your questions and answers. And of course, we have the men's meeting on October 4th when men, we can deal with some of these issues. And I will be speaking with the elders on Tuesday about some other ways we can build on this in other forums. Then there will be a supplement, God willing, that Sal Macaluso is planning to do in October. And this, what you will hear will be, I'm sure, a much fuller expose of what Sal gave me in a page and a half. If you are not convinced by the biblical materials that, ladies, you and your daughters are being made market of by the fashion industry, you're going to be convinced by Sal's presentation. I mean, so this is the way we're going to do it, and that will be a supplement to the material. Now, my goal, and I think the goal of the session, is not to make new laws. We're not going to start a fashion Gestapo in the church here. As soon as you make laws, you're either too loose or you're too strict. That's not the goal at all. But it is rather to get to the heart of the issue of modesty and to give practical guidance so that we as a church, as families, as individuals, reflect the holiness that God's people are meant to show, even in their dress. When God says man looks on the outward appearance, that's not a critique, it's a truth. People can't see what's in your heart, they'll see what's on the outside. And as you'll see, even from the meaning of the words, what you wear on the outside is an indicator of what you are on the inside. And the reason for doing this is threefold. Number one, for the honor of Christ. I'm saddened to say that this past summer, Christ was not honored by the dress of some of our church members. Number two, the testimony of this church. We are concerned that this church have a corporate testimony of the holiness and the grace of God. Now, there's a difference when someone comes in who's not converted, who may look like she was just picked up from a brothel. May we never exclude someone who comes to worship to hear the gospel like that. Never. And if you look down on people like that and you stick up your nose at them, you get down flat on your face and pray that God give you forgiveness. Because if it weren't for the grace of God, you could be just like that. May we never exclude someone who comes to the assembly to learn about the Lord God, regardless of what that person is wearing. But for those of you who profess Christ, a different standard altogether. You're to shine as lights in the world, and so your testimony individually and our testimony as a church is at stake. The third reason is this. It's for the good of everyone, not least our girls and our boys. Now, brothers and sisters, I'm not going to speak as bluntly as I've heard some people speak about modesty and issues. I'm not comfortable with even some of the modern language that's used to describe body parts in a class. I'm just not comfortable with that. I could be as earthy as anyone. But I do intend to be blunt. There is no escaping the fact that with the rise of immodesty, there is a rise of a loss of innocence. And with the rise of a loss of modesty, there is the inevitable rise of the loss of virginity, both male and female. I'm concerned for my own sons and my daughter that they keep their innocence until they're married. And I have no less standard for my children. And you shouldn't have that either. Therefore, I am concerned for my boys and my daughter that they neither tempt someone else so that that person violates his or her virginity, nor that they be tempted in that way. Marriage is honorable in all, and the bed undefiled, fornicators and idolaters, God will judge. The result of this loss of innocence in more ways than one is not only guilt, but promiscuity. And what comes, and any pastor will tell you this, it comes with the inevitable problems in marriage. You get a couple that's kept itself pure before marriage, and they'll take to the intimacies of marriage like a duck takes the water. You take a couple that has played around before marriage just with one person or many others, and inevitably, the scars of problems come in. Inevitably. And speaking as a pastor, I don't want to have to deal with an increasing number of those problems. And you don't want to have to deal with that in your own homes. And incidentally, I'll just make this other cultural note. I was brought up in the 60s when we were taught, you liberate yourself, you experience your freedom, and you do it in part sexually. You realize what a devil's lie that is? You do that, and you experience the worst kind of bondage. That is utterly the devil's lie. Women today, under the guise so often of being liberated and being truly female, are oppressed and they're treated like cattle. And the Christian faith has historically elevated whole cultures to rise above that. And I want you and I want me to be a part of that solution rather than the problem. Two further notes and then we'll get to the material today. This material, ladies, is going to apply necessarily, not exclusively to you, but primarily to you, and there's a reason for that. Men respond to sight. Ladies, you wear immodest garb, and a man cannot help but be tempted. Now, it's the man's sin, but he gives in to temptation, but you're not to be a stumbling block. So necessarily, ladies, this is going to have to deal primarily with women, although there'll be some applications to men as well. But this is not finger-pointing. I am intentionally not finger-pointing. I can see any number of reasons why there would be problems with immodesty. And these are assumptions that I'm making. Number one is that there's simply thoughtlessness. You just capitulate to the culture. And I think in a lot of cases, immodesty is just that. Now, capitulating to the culture is wrong. But that's thoughtlessness, not willful rebellion. Number two, and particularly moms with your daughters, I'm convinced there's not a little ignorance of what it is that tempts a man and makes fuel inside that man ignite into the spark of lust. And it's incumbent not upon the church, but upon parents, particularly moms with their daughters, to explain something of those dynamics. But there's ignorance involved, I'm sure, in some cases. Number three, I think there's carelessness. We're a careless culture. We don't think a lot of times but just what we do. And so I think that's part of the problem. But I do also believe that at least at times there are less than God-glorifying motives than what even some of you wear. Now, I don't judge the heart, but these are the four reasons I can see that might cause immodesty. But those are the premises under which I'm working. Now, with that long introduction, and with my 20 minutes left, turn to 1 Timothy 2 and verse 9. I want to begin with a simple premise. And as I began to think about how to deal with the topic, I came back to this utterly simple premise over and over and over again. And I think it's kind of a bumper sticker kind of a premise. Here it is, 1 Timothy 2 and verse 9. And here's where we're going to plop ourselves today. Actually, let's read verses 8 through 10. And skip all the question of what context is this. I know it's worship, but I don't think it's exclusively worship. Skip those larger questions and just focus on verses 8 through 10. I desire that the men, males, pray everywhere, lifting up holy hands without wrath and doubting. In like manner also, that the women adorn themselves in, now note the word, we're going to come to it in a moment, modest apparel with, note the word, propriety, and note the word, moderation. We're going to consider those three words. Not with braided hair or gold or pearls or costly clothing. The point is, it's not that you can't have your hair braided or wear gold or pearls or costly clothing, but that's not where your adornment is. But which is proper for women professing godliness with good works. Now that will come to, God willing, next week. But for now, particularly verse 9. In like manner also, that the women adorn themselves in modest apparel. Now, here's my simple premise. If the Apostle Paul says that women are to adorn themselves in modest apparel, therefore there must be immodest apparel. You can't speak of distinctively modest clothing if there's not also immodest clothing. Now, I'm not even raising the question of whether people did wear immodest clothing in the assembly. The point is, there is such a thing as immodest apparel because there must be this adjective, modest, describing apparel. Now, that's my simple premise. Now, with that, let me give you some definitions. And again, this is a framework, just the meaning of biblical terms. Let me give you a secular definition of modesty. This is from a typical Webster's unabridged dictionary. And if you're going to have a dictionary, at least get an unabridged one. Don't get the baby food of an abridged dictionary. Get a good, big abridged one, and then you get even the exercise of lifting it. But this is from a Webster's unabridged dictionary. Modesty. Quote, behaving according to a standard of what is proper, or you can either pronounce it decorous or decorous, and decorous means fitting to the occasion. Modesty is behaving according to a standard of what is proper or decorous, decent, pure. Now, especially, not displaying one's body. Now, that's a secular definition, and that's not from this Webster's Dictionary of 1840 or whatever it is. This is one from the latter part of the 20th century. Modest, a sense of propriety, decency, chastity, purity, moderation, freedom from exaggeration or excess. Now, what do secular definitions of modesty mean? Well, I think you can summarize it in four ways. Number one, it is proper to the occasion. Obviously, what I would wear when I work out in the garden is different than what I wear on the Lord's Day. And so we're not saying that you have to wear one thing all the time. It's got to be suitable or proper for different occasions or the occasion. Number two, and not disconnected from it, is it's got to be connected with purity and chastity if it's modest. Number three, summarizing what's said, there's a certain carefulness or thoughtfulness in what is considered, free from exaggeration or excess, decent, chaste, pure. Are you thinking about those things in modesty? Number four, having standards, behaving according to a standard of what is proper or decorous. Remember, there's always standards in fashion, folks. Everybody has certain standards. The fashion industry standards, as you'll find out, change from year to year, and that's intentional. And I mean, completely apart from the issue of modesty, is that really why, how you want to be governed? And so those things are there, propriety for different occasions, purity, chastity, carefulness, thoughtfulness, and having standards. Now, that's secular definition.